R22, tout le monde. Antenne, tout le monde.
It's hot and it's getting hotter. As the machinery of capital extraction, industrialism and consumption refuses to relinquish its grip, temperatures continue to rise. Meteorological systems change, colossal fires and sandstorms rage, and entire islands and their modes of existence sink into saltwater graves. But the overheating we are feeling is not merely meteorological. For many in the global south, atmospheric changes are just one element of a now accelerating spread of the long-standing toxicity of late liberalism. Now, describing late liberalism as toxic might seem a metaphorical flourish to some. For them, toxicity is a technical term referring only to those substances that are biologically noxious or poisonous, those things that have the capacity to disrupt biological function. But all substances, as Derrida once wrote, can move from medicine to poison, from hero to scapegoat. Even the purest of waters can be toxic to humans if taken in sufficiently large doses. Thus, medical discussions of toxicity typically emphasize the means by which toxins enter the body and the amount a body can process safely without and before being overwhelmed. Climatic overheating, temperature and humidity, while technically external to the body, can nevertheless disrupt internal biological functions as profoundly as any toxin. High temperatures don't literally boil the blood, but they place certain cardiac functions under serious stress in the healthiest of individuals, and they raise the level of ozone and pollutants that can dramatically affect pre-existing cardiovascular and respiratory diseases. In this way, rising temperatures and humidity are part of a more general expansion of uninhabitable hot zones. What surprise, then, that current advice for mitigating the effects of climate change sound eerily like older advice for interacting with chemical toxins? Don't let the heat in, i.e., seal yourself off with air conditioning and air purifiers, or remove yourself from the contaminated area, i.e., join the great climate migration. What surprise, then, that we find the grammar of contemporary late liberal climate politics composed in such a way that liberalism remains the subject pondering a problem outside of itself? T.J. Demos has noted that the common ideological backdrop of technological solutions to climate toxicity is the liberal human, i.e. the white European diasporic subject. In his words, anthropos in this narrative, which we have to translate into the white European diasporic subject, figures as the ultimate self-creator for whom no challenge, climate change, agricultural failure, artificial intelligence, planetary hunger, even death and extinction, is beyond his technological overcoming. Lest do we hear an understanding of early or late liberalism as itself the effect of a complex of feedback loops. But we have to remember, liberalism did not predate the beginning of this toxic outspilling. Liberalism is the effect of an original toxic dispossession. This was what Aimé Césaire and a long lineage of brilliant folks coming out of the Caribbean noted, that the atrocities of colonialism do not ultimately return to their source, but of course they are always poisoning the poisoners. What those poisoners were able to do is simply maintain a barricade around themselves or bury it so they could not see what they were doing. The great cities of Europe and its diaspora exist as a material and now technological condensation and displacements of countless despoiled and depopulated spaces which would become the rural and wasteland areas outside their own cities. Climate toxicity, gerontopower, emerges from the minerals dug out of the Congo, out of South Africa, out of Australia, out of Canada, that went somewhere, that left behind something. Now these hot zones are creeping and lapping at the edges of the European diaspora's manicured lawns. Thus today, I think, we see, at least if not the collapse of what I've called gerontopower, that is, the division of life and non-life, as a claim about existence, but actually a governance of existence, we see the collapse, the teetering, if not collapse, of that division, even as the collapse is occurring at a moment in which a tipping point in climatic and toxic existence is threatening what we, some of people, call Gaia. We should not glamorize or sanitize the conditions of this epistemological and ontological collapse, that is, the collapse of gerontopower. Being in this current moment, when the toxins that produced liberalism and initially was able to keep certain forms of poisoning outside of itself, even as itself was conditioned on those poisons, being within this current moment of late liberalism doesn't look especially good. We have, on the right and the left, forms that some want to call fascism. We have clown parties and lederhosen northern leagues. We have Maoist political correctness and MAGA Trumpites. We have the privilege, or I am really feel quite privileged. We have the great privilege of having some of the most innovative minds in Europe gathered with us over the next 2 days to try and lead us through some of the complex sociological and gerontological histories and conditions of our unequally experienced world. And although the colloquium is titled Gerontopower, and I'm totally honored to, by the acknowledgement of my work, then I stomp like a horse, I'm equally grateful that what we're going to hear over the next 2 days is not a reiteration of my thinking. I'm not French in that way. North, right, gender, maybe, I don't know. Anyways, we're not gonna hear a reiteration of my thinking, but instead we're gonna hear the rich terrain that has long been thinking about and is currently thinking about how it is to be a political and social subject as gerontological power teeters. And so what I want to welcome you is to that conversation that will begin tonight, go on tomorrow, and continually culminate, not in a solution, but in the rich texture of the problems we face. But the gratitude, my gratitude really extends, for gratitude for this colloquium, extends to the amazing work that Eileen and Marco have done. I have to admit that we spoke of what to do, but then they did it while I was not doing it. And they brought us all together. And so first of all, and I should also say Lauren and the great team at Reed Hall and the Alliance program, which is a joint academic venture with Columbia. So please thank them before we even start.